everybody. My name's Chris Young. I'm an alcoholic. And glad to be here tonight. It's always a nice assignment when you get asked to give back to Alcoholics Anonymous. So, and I hope everybody had a nice day yesterday. And it's interesting. Sometimes we make a big deal out of holidays, and other times it's another day. My sponsor told me it was Monday yesterday, so, you know. I have a sobriety date. My sobriety date is June 23rd, 1986. I have a home group. It's the Churchland group, has been mentioned, which, by the way, we have a really grand celebration there tomorrow night with a speaker, if you're able to attend. That's 8 o'clock at the Centenary Methodist Church on Cedar Lane. And and a certain someone is picking up a medallion for whole bunch of 24 hours, right, Leo? I also have a sponsor. His name is Carl, and I'm lucky to have him. I've always had sponsors, not the entire time, but close to the entire time I've been in AA. Some of you will understand, I really did not need one at the very beginning. But I got over that, you know, fortunately. I got over that. I was born in Connecticut and raised in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, ski country. And my mother was a registered nurse my father was a pharmaceutical salesman. And they moved to New Hampshire and they bought a ski lodge. My mother's brother had done that a few years before, and they'd gone up to visit him and found they really, really, you know, enjoyed that lifestyle. You worked really, really hard when the white stuff was on the ground, and then the rest of the year you did other stuff, you know. And so that was the environment that I grew up in. We'd have these big Trailways buses show up at the top of the driveway late on a Friday night, and they'd be there for ski weekends. There'd be about 90 teenagers and 85 to 90 teenagers and a half a dozen chaperones. And they would come from these CYO groups from Hartford, from Providence, from New York City, from Fall River, from New Bedford, and they'd all come up there to ski, some of them for the very first time. I had two brothers. I had an older brother, 5 years older than me, and I had a younger brother that was 13 months younger than me. There's a lot of stuff happened in the home that I grew up in. There's a lot of love in the home that I grew up in. There's a lot of discipline in the home that I grew up in. There's a lot of fighting in the home that I grew up in. There was a lot of drinking in the home that I grew up in. You would find no pints in the Young household. Everything was purchased by the half gallon. So early on, I got my taste, you know, because booze was everywhere. Early on, I got my taste of booze. And stealing sips as a young kid. But it was those blessed snowbanks that really offered the best liquor. Because when those teenagers would come up for their ski weekends, you know what they had hidden in their suitcases, you know. And so as soon as they got off the buses, you know, they'd be out roaming around the property looking for a convenient hiding place. And man, oh man, that was like hitting the jackpot, man. Especially when the snow would melt a little bit and the sun would hit the colored bottles, you know, and it would be like a beacon saying, Chris, come get me, you know. And so I started really, really early. And thankfully, I stopped really, really early. I used to hear the term teenage alcoholic and would laugh. But that's exactly what I was, you know. I barely made it out of high school. You know, I was not a good student. I had a lot of things on my mind, and I was not a good student. And I had two brothers that would bring home straight A's, and I would bring home straight C's. And it was no big deal for them to bring home straight A's. But when I brought home straight C's, it was time for a freaking block party. I mean, it was really, it was amazing. Interesting message, you know, as I look back on all that, the message being sent, you know. But in any event, when I found alcohol as a young preteen, really, it was just an amazing gift, you know. All that differentness, oddness, awkwardness, flawedness, not measuring up, not fitting in, all that kind of stuff just vanished. You know, it really just vanished. And I pursued drinking with a vengeance. You know, I never got enough. It's possible I still maybe have never got enough. But, you know, I drank, you know, like I think of, you know, like pigs at a trough. You know, I mean, I just never got enough. And I barely made it out of high school. I was set to join the Navy, and my dad told me that in New Hampshire they have a really good deal where you can apply to the university system, and if your grades were not good enough, you know, they'll accept you, but then farm you out to a smaller state school. So that's what happened to me. A place called Keene State College, a Keene place. And I remember being there. I remember my roommate selling mescaline, and I remember settling down to doing some serious drinking without that having to look over my shoulder as much, you know? I definitely was not invited back for a second year, you know? And next thing you know, I was back in that hometown, that small hometown, and good things were not happening, bad things were happening. And I remember getting in an argument over a case of beer with this police officer, which was really poor judgment on my part, because he was a police officer and I wasn't, you know, and we were on Main Street. But the thing was that I used to buy him beer when he was a cadet, you know, you know how we're a little narrow when people change the rules on us, you know, we don't really like that, you know. So, you know, he told me to give him the beer back. You know, you can't buy beer, Chris. You know, you're not old enough. And I just didn't want to do it. So there we are out on Main Street in this little town, and that did not go well. But when the district court judge suggested there were opportunities for a guy like me in the armed forces, man, I jumped all over that. That was a great gift, you know, because I was looking at 30 days in a farm, actually in Ossipee, like a penal farm situation. So I ended up being able to join the Navy. It seemed really clear to me early on that the Navy had no problem with you taking a drink or two, you know. There's a lot of drinking going on, and I fit right in with all that. I ended up spending 20 years in the Navy, and if you'd have told me that that would have happened, I just would have never believed it. Like everything else, you know, I thought I knew a whole lot about everything, and I just didn't. The Navy was really, really good to me. The Navy tolerated me during that first hitch. You know, I wasn't the best sailor. I would try to, some of you will be familiar with, you know, putting on that act where you try to outperform people, you try to put on the mask and be the superstar and be the, you know, the top banana or whatever, you know, inside you're just dying. And I did a lot of that. And they Of course, it's good cover for when you mess up, because they tend to look the other way. And so that went on for quite a while. I had gotten married to my end of high school sweetheart, and I just tell you that I was a horrible husband and a horrible father. I mean horrible in the context of, like, there was a lamp on the nightstand on her side, you know, and back in those days we went through a pay line on the ship, and you were paid in $20 bills. Well, I knew what the power bill was down there in Charleston, was my first duty assignment, and I knew what the power bill was, so I'd slide those 20s underneath the base of the lamp. But, you know, by the time it was time to pay that power bill, I had found it necessary to go back there over and over and over. You know, first one $20 bill, and then another $20 bill, and then another $20 bill. And you ever go drink all night at the bar, and then you get home around midnight or whatever, and you just get this weird feeling. You just came home a little early, and you just feel like having one more. And you go back, and so you go underneath the lamp, and you get the, you know, and not a good husband, not a good father. Lots of good intentions, but not good action. I can remember my first wife. I say first, I get married a lot, and divorced a lot, and my first wife Linda. I can remember her, you know, knocking on doors. This was when we upgraded from the roach infested trailer that I had her living in when we first got married, underneath the flight line in Charleston, the Air Force Base flight line. And now we had an apartment on the other side of town, and I can remember her going down the row of, like, I don't know, townhouse apartments or whatever, knocking on the door, you know, asking to borrow the microwave to warm up the baby's formula. And I can promise you, I never intended for that to happen. But drinking came first. You know, drinking came first. Drinking always came first. Lots of good intentions, but really struggled to make it right with the actions. And in fact, I remember the last time she left, or the next to the last time she left, you know, because we do that thing too. I remember her standing, you know, in the apartment holding our daughter Kendra, you know, and it was the middle of the afternoon on a work day. And the only reason I was there is because I really wanted to be there, you know, and I had a tumbler of something in my hand. And I remember her giving me this ultimatum. But it wasn't like a harsh ultimatum, but it was a firm ultimatum. You know, it's either us or that, you know, gesturing to the tumbler in my hand. But she didn't realize, you know, that come on. I mean, does that make any sense whatsoever? You know, how do you put somebody in a position like that? You know, that's... the decision was already made, you know. The decision was already made, and you know, I pretty much kicked her out, you know, so that I could drink and not have somebody leaning over my shoulder all the time trying to tell me what to do. She called the first ship so many times. I had so many flat tires. Sick. He's on his way in. He had to stop at the clinic. He's got a cold, you know. She just tried so hard, and I treated her so poorly. You know, I could just go on and on with this thing with my relationship with alcohol. You know, I heard a speaker say one time, you know, that he was a horrible dancer, but, you know, give him a couple of drinks and he just drink like, dance like Fred Astaire, you know, and that's the deal. That's the deal with me. I just, it made me feel so whole, you know. It's the only time I I really felt okay, you know, was to lean in with the drinking as much as I could, I guess you'd say, get away with, you know. And I was in an environment that was permissive of that to some extent. And even then, I would push those boundaries. I remember transferring up here to Norfolk, and I had a lot of time in between duty stations. I was up in New Hampshire on leave with my family, and I just knew that the people down at the Z Bar down in Charleston were probably missing me a lot. So I got on a People's Express airplane, flew back down there. I told the banker who I got a personal loan from for $1,000 that somehow my sea bag had been lost and I needed to replace my sea bag before I reported to my new duty station. Thought it was a pretty damn good lie. But I mean, I think it was 3 or 4 days later that $1,000 was gone. And I was asking my father to send me a ticket to get back up to New England, because I still had another 30 days or so to go before I had to report into Damneck for school. So he wired me the money for the ticket. So we flew from Charleston to Boston, and then there's going to be this little hop, this little commuter flight from Boston up to Portland, Maine, which was really about an hour or so away from my house. And I told him on the phone when I asked him for the money, you know, that, you know, they got me pretty good, Dad. You know, there was four of them. You know, and they got me, they stole the money, you know. That's why I'm calling you for money, because I got mugged, you know. I told him if it was just two of them, you know, I could have handled it, but it was four of them. And right about the time the plane touched down in Boston, had about an hour layover. And I started remembering the lie that I had told him. I remember going into the men's room in Logan Airport and standing in front of the mirror, trying to wait and see in my peripheral vision when it was slowed down with influx of people, and punching myself in the face, which is really not easy to do when you're sober, because I really wanted to make that lie real. And some people don't think alcoholism is a sickness, an illness. I didn't have the presence of mind to realize that, you know, what I'd really have an hour later is a really pink face. You know, I didn't realize that he would know immediately that I was lying. But, you know, I transferred to Norfolk and everything just kept going. Navy superstar in my mind by day, you know, knee-walking, commode-hugging, snot-slinging, drunk by night. Duality, you know, leading two lives. And I remember the day when the gig was up, you know, and I just had reached that point. And I had tried to stop many times. I had tried many mechanisms to stop. We've all read about a lot of that stuff in this thick blue book up here. But that particular day, I had been kicked out of the dockside on Hampton Boulevard at least twice. And I put a bottle underneath the dumpster earlier in the day, knowing that this would happen. But I couldn't find, when I got kicked out the last time, I couldn't find the bottle under the dumpster. And I finally found it was empty. I already raided the bottle. And it was not good. It was just, it was like hell on earth. That there was a bar, they weren't going to give me any more booze, and my stash was gone, and I was drunk, and I was beaten. And I remember hearing a tractor trailer hit the air brakes. And I started across that field behind the dockside. And I was just thinking, even as they're hitting the brakes, coming down to that stoplight there before they cross the road and go into the Norfolk International Terminals, I remember thinking, even 5 or 10 miles an hour, you know, dive out in front of one of them, that'll be the end of that. You know, no more pain, no more hurt. And I started across the field, as I recall, and then I started to run and I tripped and I fell. And then now I was on the ground. And I just remember asking for help in a way that I never had asked for help before. I never was with a vengeance, with an earnestness that I never had before. God, please help me. And the short story is I've never taken another drink again. The next day I got this crazy, crazy, crazy thought of turning myself in. Now, I had spent years in the Navy hiding, protecting, but now I was asking for help, and I asked my division officer, my senior chief wasn't there that day, and I asked my division officer if I could have a word with him, and he said, sure, you know, and pulled him over between a couple of fire control consoles and CIC on the USS Hayler, and I told him, I'm an alcoholic and I need help. And he didn't know what to do. You know, he patted me on the back and said, it's going to be all right. Take the day off. Just go have a couple of beers. You're going to be fine. Very well-meaning, very well-intentioned young officer. So I told him, you know, I'm really, really serious. I need your help. I've tried many, many times to stop drinking. I cannot stop drinking. I'm going to die, and I need your help. So then his next question was, how long has it been since you've been divorced now? And I'm thinking, well, you know, this is apples and oranges here. Even my mush head, I can figure that out, you know. And he said, you know what, why don't you take a couple of days off? And Andrea, what he said was, go have a few beers and find yourself some companionship. It's as much as I can clean it up. And something just snapped inside me. And I reached out and I grabbed him by the top of his summer white uniform. And I'm not a grabbing guy. Never have been a grabbing guy. Not a grabbing guy today. But something just snapped inside me and I was desperate. And I told him, I really need help. Please, please help me. And you know how that is with the, they're still like that today. I work around them all the time. The officers do not like that at all. They don't, they're very narrow about certain things. That's one of those things. I was in handcuffs moments later. And you want to talk about, humble pie, incomparable demoralization that you were reading earlier, you know, because in his mind, he thought I was one of his top guys. I mean, there were people senior to me getting farmed out to different parts of the ship so that he could assign me certain tasks, you know, and of course that all went right to my head and, you know, but now I was in handcuffs being let off the ship, and a saving grace was that independent duty corpsman intercepted our little handcuff party, and they gave him the key and they turned me over to him, and he took me to a medical guard ship, and I only had to lie to that medical officer a little bit in order to get the help I needed. His name was Ron Nelson. He was a first class corpsman, and I feel like he saved my life. So next thing you know, I'm in Portsmouth on the psych ward at the Portsmouth Naval Hospital. And man, oh man, I tried, you know, the following morning, strip you down to nothing, you know, and foam rubber slippers and a hospital gown. And I was at the door the next morning when the doc came in for years I thought she was a charge nurse, but it was a doctor. Her name is Sarah Moore. She practices today in Portsmouth. She still practices. And I told her, I got to talk to you, doc. There's been a mistake. Got to talk to you. And she encouraged me to give her a few minutes to hang up her coat, you know, and get a cup of coffee or whatever. And I remember her at her desk when I finally got in her office, you know, sitting peacefully, you know, at her desk. And I closed the door, her office door. I came in and closed the door, and I told her, you know, there's been a terrible mistake, that these people are crazy out here. And she just sat there and smiled, you know, that just that little faint sort of smile, you know, the one that says, yeah, they sure are crazy, and you're right where you need to be. And I went up one side of her and down the other, you know, did everything I could do to get sprung, you know, from that place. And they knew too much, and they cared too much. They knew their jobs, and they took them very seriously. They seen guys like me coming from 10 miles away blindfolded, you know. They knew just what to do. 24 hours later, the charge nurse saw me staring out the window at this bench that looks out over Portsmouth Norfolk Harbor, and she said, my guess is, if I let you go over there and sign out on that logbook right there, that you'd go out the door and write down and outside to that bench, and you'd sit right there and think about things for a while, and you'd be back here in an hour, right? And I said, you bet. I think I was back in 35 minutes, man. I was so scared that I would stay longer than the hour. But I saw my whole life flash before me, you know. It was 5 days before my 24th birthday. That night, well, the following morning when I woke up, I had an HA sitting in a chair beside my bed, and I had a strap over just below my knees, and a strap over my chest, and he's sitting in a chair right beside the bed holding my hand. I freaked out when I came to. Ernie and was it Tim? Told me that around that time they were doing, was it humanistic was the word you used? A humanistic approach to therapies, where they were really trying to convince the patients that, you know, they were good friend, you know, good people, and really caring at a human sort of level. They could care all they want, but I just wanted out of that place, you know. And there was a guy in there that kept saying that he wished he was a mercenary so that he could legally kill people. And I'm thinking, I'm done here, you know. Let me. I just want a drink. I mean, he wants to kill people. I just want a drink. So but I got a chance to go to treatment shortly thereafter. Treatment was 6 weeks long. Returned to my ship, made some cruises. I heard some good stuff in my first AA meeting. I heard a lady named Gladys. And Gladys said something along the lines of, you never again have to hurt this bad so long as you live, if you trust in God and clean house. Now, long time later, I found it in the Big Book. So, but those people were laughing up there. Big, tall John, little, they were laughing. I couldn't quite understand why they were laughing, but I understand today just fine. So, you know, my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous started at a hospital, and I got to be one of the most fortunate people you're ever going to meet. You know, I just, despite my pride, my ego, my arrogance, my know-it-all attitude, my wearing of masks to make you think certain things about me that might not be true, despite all that kind of stuff, self-centeredness, did I not mention self-centeredness? You know, despite all those things, I've been able to lead, you know, an amazing life, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember getting a sponsor, and it being suggested to have a sponsor, you know. And this guy, let's say his name was Dave, and you know, he would come to my first home group, the Bow Creek group in Virginia Beach, and he would whine. He would whine about being a lawn boy. He'd say, I'm 40 years old, I'm just a lawn boy and cut people's grass, you know, and just whine. And I said to myself, yes, that is my sponsor right there, man. So I got a hold of Gary, and I called him once or twice. I don't know if he ever called me back or not. That was the end of that, you know. And then the day came when I got my first real sponsor, you know, not just one to get the counselors happy and get people off my back. And his name was Jim McKnight. And he was 50 years older than me. He used to say there's no such thing as a hopeless case. He used to say, with, let's see, at that time, 25, 26 years of sobriety, he used to say when he got a chance to share, and he always raised his hand before he shared, little pet peeve of mine, not that we're into any controversies in AA, but I learned that you raise your hand before you speak in AA, that it's a privilege to speak in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Jim would never share without saying, with 25, 26 years of sobriety, that there's no seniority in Alcoholics Anonymous. Whoever got up the earliest this morning and is working a program of recovery, that's the most sober person in the room. He said, my higher power speaks to me through the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is why you'll find me attending meetings frequently, because his higher power speaks to him through people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can tell you the same thing now, for me. He loved me as a very unlovable creature, you know. And I made it to 5 years of sobriety before he passed away. It was really, really difficult. I visited him just a few months ago. He resides in Arlington National Cemetery. And he had met Bill Wilson on a couple of different occasions. He had become the president. I mean, I know this is not his talk here tonight, but, you know, just because it could be useful to somebody else. He reported to me that around the 5 year mark that he had become sort of like president of AA. After all, he'd met Bill, you know, and he had 5 years of sobriety in the late 40s, you know. I mean, you're going back to the very original tier here, you know. And one day he went back to his old haunt. No alarm went off, you know, and apparently he'd been there before, because she said, you know, the usual 7-up, Jim? And he said, yeah, let me make it a 7-7. 11 years later, he came back to Alcoholics Anonymous through a mental institution. So I learned early on, not a good idea to become president of AA. But he really, really loved me a lot. I remember going to him with my steps. Not that he decided I should do those steps, but I decided, because I already told you, I know a lot of stuff, right? So I had decided when I should do those steps. And I remember, you know, bringing him my step four on two different occasions. And next thing you know, we're talking about step one. And I'm thinking, yeah, he's getting old, you know. He doesn't understand, you know. This is step four, you know. Sick. So sick. I couldn't get out of my own way. Trying really, really hard. Trying so hard to be accepted by you. You know, if you don't accept me, you know, you're really screwed if you don't get accepted in Alcoholics Anonymous, huh? And I tried so hard. And it's funny how all that changes over time. Those things that seem so important seem to dissipate. You go to enough step studies, you go to enough speaker meetings, you work enough steps, you have good sponsors. When I say good sponsors, I don't what I mean is people that are willing to take up time with me, people that are willing to sit with me, people that are willing to tolerate my craziness, you know? How many people do you know get married and divorced by the time they're 46 years old? Four times. Did I not mention that? Was that a Freudian slip there? How many people do you know? Do you know anyone? Well, besides me. Married and divorced four times by the time they're 46 years old. So we've heard the expression about having a screw loose, but we're talking about the whole circuit board, you know, here. So for a while, I did blame Leo because he married me the last couple of times. You know, Leo once said in a meeting, it was a very crowded meeting, and he said, you know, Chris might not tell you this, but I married him, but I've married him twice. And then he paused and said, just one minute. What I mean to say is I officiated the ceremony twice. We've never been married. I couldn't begin to tell you all the wonderful things that have come to pass. You know, I've come to thank God for the wonderful things in life and thank God for the tragedy in life. You know, much of the tragedy in my life is self-generated, self-made, but some of it has not been. You know that expression, sometimes people say, well, some days you're the bug and some days you're the windshield. Well, that really gets a guy like me thinking, you know? And it's just amazing when I can let go and let God. You know, I heard a speaker say one time, get out of God's way. Oh my gosh, what a concept to meditate on. Get out of God's way. And when I can do that, I find that I create a whole lot less junk, pain in my life, you know? Amazing things have come to pass. You know, I was three years sober, and my sponsor sent me to Al-Anon. What the heck, you know? Again, I'm thinking he's got a screw loose or something, you know? And so I went, you know, I went on Tuesday nights. I went out at Sandbridge, and those ladies accepted me. It was a beautiful thing for about a year and a half. And then some other guy came in there, and he was brand new. Wrecked everything, just wrecked it. I hung on the rest of the time I was on shore duty, I hung on, but then I ditched them, you know, focus on that guy. So less than a year after that, I was directed to the Blackstone Retreat. Amazing, amazing. I remember this couple in Virginia Beach, Rick and Helen. I was sitting with them in the auditorium before the first meeting started on Saturday, and I saw this gentleman come in on the other side of the room, and he had on a three-piece suit. He had on a beautiful silk tie. The shoes must have been Italian, you know, and I'm asking Rick and Helen, well, who the heck is that? I mean, is that like a senator or a congressman or something, you know? And they said, oh, no, that's Hal. Go say hello. Go say hello. You know, me. Yeah, you. Go say hello. Well, they wouldn't leave it alone. So finally I get up and I go introduce myself. You know, see, I just knew that he was a big shot. He's a regular shot. You know, he's not a big shot, you know. He was a big shot, but he lived as a regular shot, you know. Amazing man, amazing man. Another one buried in Arlington, retired Air Force colonel. Took up time with me during the first Gulf War when I was out on an oiler. Not the friendliest environment in the world on a military sealift command oiler where there's lots of civilian mariners out there that are tooting it up, drinking it up, and I'm clean and sober, and these big manila envelopes started showing up, and they were filled with these things called cassette tapes, and Hal was just going from roundup to roundup, you know, and he would send me these tapes, you know, Texas, California, the Dakotas. It's just amazing, amazing. And I'd lay there in my rack or sit at my little desk in this little tiny stateroom that kind of a special deal. It's the only time I ever had a stateroom, believe me. And But God, I just, every word was like golden, you know. I just savor every single word from those tapes, that sharing, you know. It's just amazing. Hal tells me, you know, do you ever come to Washington? Well, my detailer's up in Washington. Sure, I'm going to be coming up there about 6 or 8 months from now. He said, don't come up without letting me know first. See if you can plan it to be up there on a Tuesday. Make a long story short, next thing you know, I'm approaching the west entrance of the U.S. Capitol. I'm getting to attend a meeting of the yays and nays group of Alcoholics Anonymous. What the heck? Me, you know? And, I mean, these are the people that you see on CNN at night, you know, and they're all there. Every Tuesday morning, 7:30 in the morning, they have a meeting. The only difference between the yays and nays group and this group right here is I absolutely assure you there's no styrofoam in that meeting room whatsoever. They drink out of china cups and saucers. And a steward brings in the urn of coffee for these guys that anonymity is such a... I don't know if that helps you, me telling you that story or not, knowing that there's a lot of the people that run the country or go to an AA meeting at the Capitol every Tuesday morning. It could spook you, but hopefully it warms your heart like it does mine. But amazing things, and getting a chance to sponsor people, getting a chance to do service work. You know, my first home group, after about a year and a half of making the coffee, this guy named Ted, he called me aside. He said, hey, you did a good job with the coffee. You're really, doing a good job with that. I said, oh, thanks. You know, go ahead, pat me on the back again if you like, you know. And he said, I do got a question. You know, how many scoops are you putting in there? So, you know, as a 40-cup coffee maker, you know, so, well, you know, eight scoops. And he said, okay. Well, just so you know, that's exactly twice as much, you know. So, you know, but they put up with that for over a year. They put up with that, you know. Got a chance to be in different service positions or whatever, and so lucky to stay connected with Alcoholics Anonymous despite lots of years of sea duty. Out of my little over 20 years in the Navy, I spent over 12 years on sea duty. Got a chance to attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in all kinds of different countries. I could go back and look for sure, but about a dozen different countries. Amazing. I came across just the other day, I was doing some cleaning and came across a placard that had the sort of a almost like a greeting card, serenity prayer on the front. And on the back, it had the signatures of maybe about 15 different people from the Ponce group, Puerto Rico. And this was in, it was within a week or two of my 10th anniversary. And somebody had asked, you know, you go to a different place, people don't know you, they ask questions, you know, and I told them, you know, I just had 10 years or what have you, and somebody grabbed the card and passed it around, you know. They never saw me before, they maybe never see me again, but just the love, you know, just the love of people in AA. I have, as you can tell, I'm very much more of a talker than I am a speaker, but, you know, there's just maybe a couple more things I could share with you about my journey. One of those is that all of this, it works in rough going. I was once at an Al-Anon conference, which I would highly recommend, and it really sort of rubs me the wrong way when I hear people knocking Al-Anon, because it's a beautiful program. And I heard this lady say that she discovered that true serenity is not the peace of mind after the storm. It's the peace of mind that you can have despite the storm, right in the middle of the storm. Man, oh man, I thought, well, here's a goal. You know, here's something I can work towards. I've been able to, by God's grace, I guess, and my good fortune, I've been able to surround myself with people that know an awful lot about sobriety. And I stick close to those people. You know, I hope it's not too awkward to say it like this, but the truth is that I don't have a ton of friends my age. All the people that I love in this world, they're 25 or 30 years older than me, which is, of course, a real setup for further on down the road. But I love these people, and I look up to these people, and these people have what I want, and so I stick with them. These are the people that I send Christmas cards to. These are the people I think of when they might share in a meeting that something's going on or whatever. I work with new people all the time. A blessing and a curse that from the time I was about 8 years sober, I've worked full-time in behavioral health care. Most of that time in, well, half of that time in direct patient care, substance abuse counseling. Great gift, tough burden. Sometimes I feel like I have to work harder at my AA principles, because in treatment centers, you know, everything gets dumbed down. I don't mean that disrespectfully, but it's just the truth, you know, because you want people to get the message, you know, and there's a dumbing down of things that happen. And so that's my experience. And so sometimes I feel like my AA program has suffered as a result of my line of work. You know, there's other times I feel like I'm richer because of it. So I guess it's just a mixed bag. But I've had amazing things happen and been able to be helpful to some people along the way. I like sponsoring people, but the only sponsoring I can do is the way I learned. I'm not exactly sure how people, you know, if we're a program that shares our experience, strength, and hope, I'm not sure I can sponsor somebody differently than how I was sponsored. And so I have a couple of sponsees that I've had long-term, but more times than not, the people that I work with are really not interested in the sort of the way that we go about it. So, but I'm always open to that, and that's, I think, a big part of my sobriety is through sponsorship. We can be a big book, you know, you know the expression about we might be the only big book that somebody sees today? I find that to be really, really true. And I'll share something with you that sort of brings that point home. And so one day I was leaving work, and as I was approaching my car, I noticed something under the windshield wiper. It was this paper right here. And it said, "Good afternoon, sir. I'm sure it's weird to find a note from a stranger on your car. I wanted to share something with you. I was walking through the parking lot one morning and asked you about your license plate." My license plate from the time I was about 3 years sober is capital F-R-E, numeral 2, D-Y. It's interesting. Pull up at a stoplight sometimes and somebody will pull alongside and, you know, give you the motion for the roll down the window. And, I don't know, is that Free to Die? And or is that Freddy or Free to Die? And I'm thinking, yeah, maybe, you know, Free to Die. The old Chris had to die for the new one, you know, to be here. But it's Free Today, you know, because the light had just come on at that point in my sobriety that all of a sudden I was free. You know, the obsession had been lifted. I was totally free, where I had always felt, you know, like something akin to some form of slavery beforehand. But now I was free. Anyway, she saw the license plate. "You told me it was because you were free from a struggle." Then in parentheses, she writes, "I do not remember the struggle. I told you I liked it and went on about my day. What you didn't know was I was going through something similar. I hadn't thought much about you after that, to be honest. But one day I was walking through the parking lot again and saw your car. I decided that day that I wanted to be free also. I've been free now for about 1.5 months and wanted to let you know that you inspired me. Thank you for taking that small moment to share with me. Sometimes we don't realize that the smallest interactions with people can have a big effect on other people's lives. You were my angel that day, and I just wanted to say thank you for letting God use you to help me. Bless you. Now, is she one of us or is she one of us? You know, God using you to help me. So I try to keep that in mind when I'm stuck in some pettiness or, you know, annoyed by something or resentful, whatever. You know, I try to keep that in mind. I really believe that there's a, you know, the concept of attitude of gratitude. I really believe that, as is so beautifully stated in, there's an excerpt from As Bill Sees It, that, you know, A Thankful Heart, it's entitled A Thankful Heart. I want to say page 27, you know, that our hearts can't contain gratitude and conceit at the same time. They don't go well together. It doesn't work. Just like in our minds, we can't seem to contain a positive and a negative thought simultaneously. You know, so what's it going to be? What's it going to be? Well, I just tell you in closing that early on in my sobriety, remember I told you about this daughter, this oldest daughter, and I used every bit of the leave time I had in the Navy to travel back and forth to New Hampshire to see this this oldest daughter, Kendra. And I was terrified of not going to meetings. You people had the answer that I wanted. And so, you know, to drive 700 miles to say hello and then I'll be right back, you know, really, really tough on a little kid, you know. I can remember seeing her stand in the window by the door, you know, just sobbing, not understanding, where's daddy going, you know. But anyway, it was in one of those meetings I encountered this guy named Bruce. And Bruce was on crutches. He was a vet. He was on crutches, and he was on those metal kind of crutches that have that grip your arm. You know what I'm saying? And he said he had a life second to none. Hobbling into the meeting on metal crutches, had a life second to none. And I sat there with coming up on a year of sobriety. And I thought, you liar. You're just lying, you know. I had no idea. But I believe Bruce. I believe Bruce for a long, long time now. Because I feel that way. I feel like despite my lower nature, whatever you want to call it, my defects of character, I've been given a life second to none, and it is no question. I mean, my whole adult life is Alcoholics Anonymous. I was I started really early and I stopped really early. Thank you.